You're listening to Succeed, Just Let Go, the podcast that'll change how you think and change your life. I'm Willie Horton and I'm a psychologist, been helping people change their lives since 1996, broadcasting from the French Alps, and delighted to have you along. Let's take this week's step in the right direction.
We're at our very best when we're not thinking. Or let me put it the other way around. Thinking gets in the way of our being at our very best. Now, I'm sure immediately you can think of situations in which thinking got in your way. Let's start with an obvious example of how thinking trips us up. A couple of years ago, I was talking with a client who, as part of his master's degree, had to produce a thesis on project management, where, amongst other things, he had to interview two or three fellow project managers in relation to what worked for them and obviously things that didn't work for them. I would talk to this guy every week in relation to something else, obviously, but having to ring these three people was constantly on his mind. He had created a spreadsheet, an Excel spreadsheet of about a dozen names of people that he thought he might ring. From one week to the next, he would tell me how he had rearranged the names on the list so that the people who were most likely to talk to him were up the top. On other occasions, he would rearrange the list so the people he was most comfortable phoning would be up the top. He would change the colour of the fonts. He would rearrange the size of the fonts on the Excel spreadsheet. He would do everything in the world except lift the phone. So I said to him one Friday morning, we'll talk again next Friday, but I'll cut the conversation short if you haven't done what you know you need to do. Stop thinking about it. And as Nike would say, just do it. The following Friday morning, we talked again. And he said to me, I rang three people yesterday afternoon. I said, why did you do it now? He said, because I was afraid of you. I was afraid that you'd hang up the phone on me if I hadn't made those calls. I said, and? He said, it's amazing how amenable people were to talk with me. It is amazing how they were willing to share their stories, how they were willing to share their insights and expertise. I said to him, which was easier to do? To lift the phone to those three people, or to think about it for weeks on end, to annoy yourself for weeks on end, to further frustrate yourself to the point where you thought there was something wrong with you because you didn't have the guts to lift the phone to three people, which was easier, thinking about it or doing it? I'm sure you have your own examples of how thinking gets in your way. That's an obvious example. Another obvious example, you have a row with your nearest and dearest last night and you go to bed without saying sorry. And you wake up this morning and you go into the kitchen to prepare breakfast and you start silently fuming to yourself, thinking about what was said or what wasn't said the previous evening, what was said in the past. And those thoughts get in the way of your starting the day in the way in which you should, with a clear mind, a focused mind, and a present mind. Again, I'm sure you have your own examples. These are obvious examples of how thinking gets in our way. But there is a more fundamental way in which thinking gets in our way, of which you may not be aware, or of which you may only be aware when it is absolutely obvious and in your face. Let's talk about how we trip ourselves up moment to moment every day. Because, even though, as I said, we are unaware of it, when we are using our minds normally, we are using our minds automatically. We are using what cognitive psychology has described on many occasions over the years as the automatic pilot. The automatic pilot is designed to enable you to do everything that you do routinely without having to pay what you're doing a blind bit of attention. What am I talking about in terms of routine? Well, I'm talking about dressing yourself, brushing your teeth, talking to other people, doing your work, doing your work in a routine way, doing the routine things that you do around the house, or from a professional point of view. Now, obviously, you might say to yourself, this is a good thing that I don't have to pay an awful lot of attention to, for example, washing the dishes. But that is only the tip of the iceberg. Now, unfortunately for us, the automatic pilot also has another facility called categorization that enables us, if that's even the right word, it actually disables us from being present and living our lives the way we should, but it enables us put any new or novel situation or any new person that we meet into a category, into a pigeonhole within 4 seconds, again without having to pay the new situation or the new individual any attention at all. This is done automatically, again, to ensure that I can go through my day without having to pay any attention to anything other than situations which may pose a threat to my life. We're talking about the way in which our brains evolved to ensure our survival. You must remember, as we said before, in evolutionary times, our goal was to survive. Your brain is designed to survive. It is not designed to enable you to achieve all the things that you would love to achieve. The only goal that your evolutionary brain has in mind is survival. And it is because of that that the automatic pilot enables us to make it through the day without paying attention to anything that we are doing. Again, you might say to yourself, well, that makes life easier for me. No, it means that you're dead from the neck up because you're paying no attention to what is actually going on in the here and now, unless you are confronted by a man or woman eating beast. And that means that you are missing each precious moment of your life as each precious moment arises. And like everything else in life, passes. It means that you are not experiencing what is actually going on. You are only thinking about what you're experiencing because the automatic pilot, in enabling you to make it through the day in survival mode, uses a bank of thoughts that it learned when you were young and impressionable during your formative years. You see the phrase formative years, the phrase young and impressionable, they actually mean something because during your formative years, when you were young and impressionable, you formed your view of how the world works. And more importantly, you formed your view of who you think you are. You formed your view of your strengths and your weaknesses. And you have been carrying all these beliefs, because that is what they are, and expectations with you throughout your adult life, since a point in time around the onset of puberty, when your learning mind closed down. You see, from an evolutionary point of view, the first 12 or 13 years of our lives were spent learning how to hunt and gather without having to pay attention to anything other than the possibility that whilst we were hunting and gathering, our lives might be at risk. That's the brain evolution gave you. In other words, nature gave you a brain that isn't fit for purpose in the 21st century. It is as simple as that. And as we said a couple of minutes ago, right at the beginning of this episode, sometimes we're a little bit more aware of our own failings than others, like my friend with the Excel spreadsheet, like getting annoyed after the event, or staying annoyed, I should say, after the event. Indeed, just as an aside, as a funny aside, the same guy who had the Excel spreadsheet was talking to me one morning, and he told me that the previous day he had woken up angry with his wife. And he went through the morning basically grunting at her. And then around lunchtime, he said to himself, why am I angry with her? She didn't do anything. We didn't have an argument. And then it dawned on him that he had had a dream the previous night where they had had an argument where something, I don't know what had happened, I don't know the details. And he couldn't remember the details other than the fact that, this is a quote, she had been mean to him. Now, this is how the brain actually operates. When we are in thinking mode, one thought is layered upon another thought so that we end up overthinking and have no idea why we started thinking on that train of thought in the first place at all, because we were never present. Now, that's a really important point, because a couple of weeks ago in one of these podcasts, we said that presence is attractive. If you're never present, you'll never have presence. You will never attract into your life the people and things that you need to enable you move effortlessly and gracefully to the life that is best for you. Now, obviously, this podcast is about moving effortlessly and gracefully to the life that is best for you, moment to moment, one precious moment at a time. And that is why, at the beginning of this episode, I said, we are at our best when we are not thinking. Let's go deeper, because we talked about strengths and weaknesses. Your strengths and weaknesses. In particular, during the third year of your life, you learned about yourself. That is because during the third year of our lives, we learn what is known as theory of mind. Around the age of two, we realize that we have to negotiate and communicate and collaborate our way through each day with other people to enable us get what we want. It's as simple as that. So therefore, during the third year of our lives, we learn how to do just that. I call them the four eights. We communicate, collaborate, negotiate, and manipulate. We learn how to manipulate people around to our way of thinking. We learn how to manipulate our way around situations to ensure that we come out with what we think we want. Now, there's another thought, which I'll come back to in a couple of minutes, what we think we want. This theory of mind, which we learn during the third year of our lives, enables us to develop the skills to ensure that as we move through our day, we encourage and then experience a meeting of minds between ourselves and others. But what we learn in the process is that, first of all, we'd like to be approved of by other people. It's what we've talked about in previous conversations as the drug of approval. And before we go any further, let's deal with that. Again, we can see how we crave the drug of approval in terms of what goes on in our minds on an ordinary, everyday basis. You're with a group of friends or acquaintances. It could be, I don't know, the gin club when you go out and sample gin on a Friday night. It could be the mates with whom you play golf on a Saturday morning. It could be fellow Liverpool fans. And that has nothing to do with the fact that Liverpool just won the Premier League. It has to do with an actual conversation I had with a client a couple of years ago who hung out every Wednesday night and every weekend with guys he went to school with. And the only thing they had in common were they were all Liverpool fans. Now, there's an interesting point that I've just made. The only thing that they had in common. Because people think that when they're hanging around with their so-called tribe, that they're part of the tribe. And they think that because it is imperative that they be part of a tribe, because in evolutionary times, if you were out on your own, you were easy pickings for men or women eating beasts. We need to be part of a tribe, or at least we think we do. And therefore, we behave in ways to ensure that the people who we share that tribe membership with like us. If they didn't like us, we might be thrown out of the tribe. In other words, we invest a lot of our energy in thinking about what other people think of us. Now, you may never have thought about it that way, but this is actually what is going on, all automatically, by the way, as we said, because of the automatic pilot. This is what is going on when, using our minds normally, we interact with our tribe. Or indeed, we interact with anybody, but let's stick with the tribe. I think about what other people think of me. This is a total and utter waste of your energy, because When you think about what somebody else is thinking about you, you're thinking about something that isn't happening because the other person is thinking about what you think of them. It couldn't be otherwise because ordinarily, as we move through our day on automatic pilot, everything we do is dictated by our thinking, because that is the fuel that drives the automatic pilot. Now, the really terrible thing about that fuel is that it is the same fuel that goes through the automatic pilot every day. You never fill up your tank. The neural lab in UCLA has calculated that fuel is comprised of 70,000 repetitive patterned pre-programmed thoughts. Pre-programmed? Yes, they were programmed into you, particularly during the third year of your life, but over the span of your formative years when you were young and impressionable. Thinking gets in the way of our even being with the tribe that we crave being part of. Let's get back to your strengths and weaknesses, and we'll start with your weaknesses because they are many. Over the years, in any face-to-face workshop that I've ever held, at some point, I will ask the question of the assembled multitudes, 5 or 6 people, do you think you're perfect? Who in this room feels that they are perfect? And of course, nobody puts up their hand, because we don't think we're perfect, because we learned during the third year of our lives about our weaknesses. And we were more inclined to learn about our weaknesses than our strengths because, again, of the way in which our brains evolved, looking at a glass half empty rather than a glass half full means that we are more alert to the things that could go wrong, more attuned to the things that might end up constituting a threat. Thinking negatively keeps us on our toes. So during the third year of your life, in particular, because of the way in which you were developing your ability to interact with other people, and therefore even at that stage, thinking about what they were thinking about you, during that third year of your life, you learned what worked for you, you learned what didn't work for you, and most importantly, you learned from what people did to you, not for you. Because for you would be positive. We're skewed to learn the negative. We learned through a process known as snapshot learning, which means exactly what it sounds like it means. Something happens to you, something is done to you, and you take a snapshot, not of what is being done to you, but how it feels when it is being done to you. In other words, this is an emotional snapshot, even though the subconscious mind is visual. In other words, it'll take a snapshot of people laughing at you, tell you a story. Many years ago, a good friend, one of my first clients, when I met him first, was what could only be described as one of the world's worst public speakers. To see him stand up in front of a group of people to make a presentation was cringing. You'd end up perspiring yourself on his behalf. He was so bad. And he told me when we sat down to talk about that particular weakness first, that he had been on every course and attended every workshop on how to make a good presentation and how to make an impression. And none of them had worked. And I said to him, when you stand up in front of people to make a presentation, you give that presentation on automatic pilot. Because that's how the normal mind actually works. And the automatic pilot obviously has a program for how you behave yourself when you stand up in front of people. It enables you make it through the presentation. Now, it doesn't enable you to make a good presentation. It just enables you survive the presentation. Because remember, our key objective in evolutionary times was survival. So we talked and talked and talked about what may have triggered him to feel that way about himself to the point where he was embarrassed standing up on his own 2 feet. Now, I should have mentioned this guy was the national sales director of an insurance company, standing up on his feet and making presentations as part of his job. And he was awful at it. Anyway, we talked, and late one evening, over a couple of beers, he told me a story that had suddenly reappeared in his mind like a light bulb going off. He said, "I was about 3 years old. It was coming up to Christmas, just past my third birthday, actually. And I grew up on a family farm in the wilds, out in the middle of nowhere. And Christmas Eve every year was a gathering of the clans. The whole family, the extended family, would arrive for a big family meal and obviously a lot of drink. And that Christmas Eve, my mother bullied me into standing up in front of everybody and doing my party piece. And just as I stood up in front of the range in the big kitchen with the assembled crowd in front of me, just as I started singing the first words of, 'How much is that doggie in the window?' two of my uncles started falling around the place laughing. I felt awful. I burst into tears and I ran out of the room." That is the program he uses automatically. He's totally unaware of it, but that is the program he uses automatically when he stands up in front of people as an adult to make a presentation. So, what is actually happening when he makes the presentation in actual mechanical terms is the automatic pilot realizes, "I am in a situation in which I have to present myself to others. What program do I have in my memory bank of programs to enable me survive this experience?" Again, bearing in mind that my objective is to survive. The automatic pilot will pick out this program, which is akin to a photograph in his family album of programs. Bear in mind, it was a snapshot learned through snapshot learning. The automatic pilot will pull up this program and run it so that he does his presentation without paying it any attention. We're back to what I said earlier on. The automatic pilot enables you to make it through the day doing everything that you do routinely without paying any attention. And he survives the presentation, and that's all. In other words, when he stands up in front of a group of people as the national sales director of his insurance company, he is, throughout his presentation, fighting the urge to burst into tears and run out of the room. That is how the automatic pilot works. It's a classic example of it. And that is how thinking stops us being at our best. But I said something else a couple of minutes ago in relation to what we learned during the third year of our lives when we needed to learn how to manipulate people to get what we wanted. Should I say, to get what we think we wanted? Here is one of the classic ways in which thinking gets in the way of our living our best life. Inevitably, during any workshop I've ever done, and obviously, in the course of the online program, Psychology of Success, my clients and online program owners have been asked, "What do you want out of life?" Now, the minute the automatic pilot hears the word want, it answers the question on the basis of thought, because everything is based on thought. Let me put this in practical terms. I recollect a conversation with a client a number of years ago when I asked him, "What do you want? What do the two of you want, yourself and your wife?" And he said, "Well, we want better holidays." I said, Why do you want better holidays?" "Because my wife says she will eventually get so frustrated with me that she will leave me because the neighbors go on better holidays than we do." Somebody else said, "I want a bigger car." Why do you want a bigger car? Because my friends have bigger cars, or because the guy down the road has a bigger car. A bigger car would make me feel better about myself. In other words, you don't feel good about yourself in the first place. In other words, you feel that you are not perfect. In other words, that you are living your life based on your perceived weaknesses. Generally speaking, when we reflect upon what we want out of life or out of any situation, we don't reflect upon it. We think about it. And one of the worst forms of ordinary everyday thinking is comparative thinking. I want what they have because they look happy and successful, and I want to be happy and successful. So I want what they have. I want the designer shoes. I want the good holidays. I want the bigger house. I want the flashy cars. I want on the basis of what other people have that I don't have. Now, obviously, that has nothing to do with what is best for you. Let me give you a classic example of that. Again, many years ago, and again, it happens to be from the life insurance industry because that is one of the industries in which I worked before I started working for myself in 1996, a long time ago. One particular early client was a guy who, when I asked him the question, "What do you want?" his answer was immediate, "I want to be the marketing director of whatever company it was." I said, "Are you sure that's what you want?" "Yes." I said, "Why?" "Because I want to climb the greasy pole. I want to get to the top." I said, "I think you're looking at it the wrong way." He said, "It doesn't matter what you think. I want to be the marketing director." I said, "Fine. Let's set your mind to enable you to become the marketing director." Now, I've used the phrase set your mind. That's a whole other discussion that we need to have, and we might have it next week. He set his mind, and there's a scientifically validated way in which he did that. And about a year later, I got a phone call from him, and he said, "I'm ringing you to tell you that I was right and you were wrong." "Na, na, 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 na." He said, "I've just been made the marketing director of that company." I said, "Well, it was inevitable because you set your mind." I said, "Congratulations." 6 months later, he rings me. He says, "I don't like this job." He says, "In fact, I hate this job. I have no idea why I thought I wanted this job in the first place. And I have just realized that I've spent the last 7 or 8 years of my career climbing the wrong ladder. I've reached the top of the hill and I do not like the view." Now, the interesting thing is that that guy now works for himself and he's very happy working for himself. He's not at the top of any greasy pole anymore. But he is happy and contented and living his best life. Before we move on, a couple of important points. Your weaknesses aren't real. They are perceived weaknesses created by psychological snapshots that created programs that are deep-seated thoughts, some of the 70,000 thoughts that we mentioned earlier on. In other words, your weaknesses are thoughts. That's all they are. They're not real. They're not just born from the psychological snapshots of specific situations that you took. They are contextualized by the environment in which you grew up. And most of us grew up in an environment where we were told that we were in need of redemption. Now, that message was delivered in a variety of different ways. If you were a Roman Catholic, well, first of all, you're probably still carrying around Catholic guilt, but that's another conversation too. But if you were a Roman Catholic, you grew up in an environment where we learned that we were stamped with the stamp of original sin. Oh, what a way to be brought into the world. God help us. But it isn't just that. The whole premise of education is that you better yourself. What's the subliminal message in relation to bettering yourself? That you're in need of improvement. So all this, what psychology calls developmental niche around you in which you took your own personal psychological snapshots all leans into you being imperfect, you having weaknesses. Your weaknesses are not real, they are thoughts and no more. Your strengths aren't real either. They're perceived strengths that you learned during your formative years too. And all these perceptions mean that you are thinking more and more, moment to moment. As we said earlier on, you're unaware of it because this is all happening subconsciously, but you're thinking and thinking and thinking yourself out of your own life. You are missing your own life as a result of all the thinking that is going on in your head. We're at our worst when we're thinking, because we're actually not there at all. Do we need to stop thinking? Can we stop thinking? You must remember that the human brain evolved over a period of about 1.8 million years, and in particular over the last 7,000 to 10,000 years, when, as we said in last week's podcast, when we talked about artificial intelligence, or as we described it at the time, perhaps artificial lack of intelligence, we started thinking in earnest. Around the time that we organized ourselves into tribes, organized ourselves into the production of food in a structured way, agriculture, about 7,000 or 8,000 years ago. So, can we stop thinking? And if we stopped thinking, what would happen? On the basis that the 70,000 thoughts that we have in our head are the thoughts that enable us to survive. Well, if we stopped thinking, it isn't that we would not survive. It is that we would actually start living, start experiencing the here and now. I said a few minutes ago that we don't experience the here and now. We experience what we think the here and now is. In other words, we see, feel, hear, smell and taste what's going on. And in order to make sense of that, we filter what our five senses are telling us through the 70,000 thoughts that enable us to make it through the day, as a result of which we create a version of reality where we actually don't know what's going on. We only think we know what's going on. More thinking. Can we stop thinking? Probably not completely, nor should we try to stop thinking. Instead, we should redevelop our ability to simply be. We were at our best psychologically, attentionally, when we were 2 or 3 years old, when we were actually taking the psychological snapshots. Indeed, we could only take psychological snapshots because we were at our best. And what I mean by being at our best was we were wholly present when we were 2 or 3 years old. If you've ever seen a 2-year-old open their presents on Christmas morning, they're completely immersed in what they're doing. They're not thinking about it. They just are. We need to get back to being. We need to get back to being totally immersed in the reality of what is going on. We do this by, this is a quote from the University of Massachusetts Medical School, coming to our senses, coming to those five senses that I mentioned a couple of minutes ago. There is a vast body of research that stretches back to the late 1980s and has been augmented as a result of science coming on in leaps and bounds through the development of brain imaging technology and the science of neuroscience in the last 20 to 25 years, that confirms that when we practice being present, not only do we experience that immersive experience that we had when we were 2 or 3 years old, not only are we wholly present, but as a result of being wholly present, we move evolution forward for us. Now, I quoted the University of Massachusetts Medical School. That's where mindfulness-based stress reduction therapy was developed. Following on from that, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy was developed. Mindfulness-based anything is basically based on meditation. 26 or 27 years research in the fields of both cognitive and behavioral psychology and neuroscience confirm that meditation restructures the brain that evolution gave you. In other words, you move your own evolution forward by restructuring neural pathways that enable you do and be rather than think. Create new neural pathways that enable you do and be rather than think. And develop the parts of the subcortical brain, the doing brain, the being brain. Develop those parts of the brain in a way where they communicate with each other so that they gradually, over time, diminish your thinking, diminish the noise created by your thought, dissolve the barriers that thought creates to your being in the here and now, knowing what is going on in the here and now, and knowing what you need to do in the here and now to get where is best for you. It's not the same as getting to what you want. It's better than that. Now, I could throw all of the science at you, and there is an enormous body of it at this stage in relation to what meditation does to your ability to start living your life to the full and being present and having the presence that is attractive that we talked about in the last couple of weeks and that I mentioned earlier on. I could throw all the science at you. The science only confirms this works for everybody, that nobody is an exception. Again, to quote the University of Massachusetts Medical School, if you can breathe, you can meditate. And when you meditate, what happens to your brain is going to happen to you as surely as night follows day. Really, what you need to do, though, is experience the difference between being and thinking. And that is what even the simplest of meditations will enable you to. We are at our best when we are not thinking. We don't have to stop thinking. We simply have to come to our senses and start being.
You've been listening to Succeed, Just Let Go. To get involved, join me in my Facebook group, strangely enough called To Succeed, Just Let Go. And for more information, visit www.willie-port.com.